Hey, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howie Jacobson. Quick reminder that the new book is out. You Can Change Other People, The 4 Steps to Help Your Colleagues, Employees, Even Family Up Their Game. This is a business book, but it's also a personal book. I wrote it from my experience as a coach, helping people change entrenched self-sabotaging behaviors. And I put all my knowledge and all of Peter Bregman, my co-author's knowledge, into a book to help you do the same thing with the people that you care about in your life. So it's available right now. It is for sale wherever books are sold. You know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookstore.org, your local independent bookshop, my personal preference, if you can do that. And I would love for you to get a copy. That is one amazing way to support me, is to help the sales of the book, and to read it and implement it. And if you like, go on Amazon or somewhere and leave a review. All right, so let's get to today's episode. So today, my buddy Glenn Murphy and I talk about a thorny problem that pretty much all of us are facing these days, which is how to evaluate claims in areas where we aren't experts. Now, I know what you're thinking, but you and Glenn, between the two of you, are experts in everything. Well, thank you very much, but no, because I'm pretty good into certain aspects of behavioral science, and I'm pretty good on the history of the New York Yankees from the late 1930s until the early 80s. But of course, that leaves an awful lot of things that I'm not an expert on. For example, health and nutrition, politics, economics, business, geology, environmental science, and just about everything else. In other words, my entire life is predicated on some kind of algorithm for deciding what I believe. And that's probably true of you as well. You know what you believe and who you believe and where you're certain and where you aren't so sure. But do you know how you arrived at your conclusions? Because I didn't. So this conversation with Glenn helped me identify and articulate my own, shall we say, epistemological heuristics, to use two words that, frankly, I'm not sure exactly what they mean, let alone how to spell them without the aid of a spell checker. And I was surprised at the high emotional valence that went into my decisions about what and who to trust. Because I want to be rational. And it was interesting to me to acknowledge just how much stake I put into, like, experts being kind and humble, as opposed to like having expertise and unvarnished authority. So Glenn and I talk frankly about the researchers and clinicians who have fallen victim to ego stroking rather than truth seeking. And we share examples from the whole food plant-based world, from the world of metabolomics, which is about, metabolism, from the arguments about who has the best martial art, and from the annals of positive and behavioral psychology. So if you're interested in the truth, I think this conversation will both challenge and delight you. So without further ado.
Howie. How are you, man? Welcome back.
Good. Thank you. Good to be here. Good to see you.
Yeah. It's been a bit. I had a 3-week to 4-week layoff from the podcast. So I had a bit of a gap there as I was traversing across the United States with my family, road tripping all the way to Texas and back, and experiencing all of the major animal phyla. I think we had, like, a bat dropped on my wife. We had a cottonmouth swimming next to us in the river. It's innumerable invertebrates and biting things. So it was quite a camping experience, but had some nice human contact as well. So that was good post COVID.
Yeah, well, the pictures all look very peaceful. They didn't indicate the
America part. The animal attacks were between the frames. There was one actually that we shared. I'm like waist deep in this river, and my kids are on a big inflatable thing. We just kind of floated down the river that we were camping next to, and right at the moment you shot it, you can see that I'm like frowning and staring at something just off shot, and that was a snake swimming past us in the water with a alarmingly flat head with a beveled bit, which is normally where my kind of rule of thumb for discerning venomous from non-venomous. If they're like smooth, like, and if, then like that, like a worm, then usually they're fine. But if the back of the head flares out a little bit, then you're like, nah, it's probably venomous. So I'm pretty sure, I think it was a cottonmouth. So so I was like, kids, stay on the inflatable. Let's wait for this guy to swim away. So that was kind of fun. So I thought we'd a bit of a chat today about partly because it's been a while since we caught up on things, and also because we've had a bit of a back and forth over text on a couple of different things, really, on some ideas relating to nutrition and some ideas relating to exercise. And then it just kind of occurred to me that this is kind of dovetailing with other conversations I'm having with my some of my systema students on kind of discerning truth from reality, insofar as we can do that, and discerning when we might be getting led astray by a really appealing idea, you know, an idea that's really exciting and it has a great story behind it. And that compelling story and maybe the, you know, the personality and the charisma of the person that's telling the story can be enough sometimes for us to be like, good enough for me. I'm pretty sure that's true. Right. And then later on, when something else comes along to contradict it, we're thrown into this kind of like, oh, man, I really wanted to believe that. And now something else is happening. I'm pretty sure both of these are true in some way, but how do I kind of reconcile that in my head? So, I mean, this is kind of something that I've been wrestling with most of my like academic life as well, as moving, you know, from trained science into additional ways of thinking, let's put it that way as well. And one that's never fully resolved, but I thought we might have a crack at some of the concrete examples of how we sort this out, how you do it, how I do it. And this might be of benefit then to people listening, whether they're trying to improve their health, like trying to improve diet, exercise, nutrition, or whether they're just trying to stay on a good path for training and keep making good progress in skill acquisition and stuff.
Sounds great. I'm in.
Cool. Right. So the problem that we're faced with right now, right, and this has always been a problem, is how do we discern what is true from what is false? And it kind of occurs to me that in terms of purveyors of falsehoods, right, there's kind of two categories. There's like your straight charlatans and liars, like people who know that they're peddling bullshit, right? Mm-hmm. They know what they've got is false, and they're just trying to, they have another motive. They have some other kind of intrinsic motivation for getting you to buy the thing or believe them or whatever it's going to be. And this can be anything from, you know, yoga gurus who want to build up a harem of women to have sex with, right? Or where it's going to be, all the way through to kind of diet gurus who kind of know that their stuff isn't really right and it's not really backed up, but they sell a lot of books and they, you know, they sell a lot of products and ideas, or like, you know, little powdered things that you pour into drinks and people lose weight. I don't know, like all that kind of stuff, right? This kind of snake oil salesman. So that's one category. But the other category of people are, a range of people who believe what they believe and that they absolutely believe it to be true. And they're spreading those ideas with a view to helping people. And this can range from the fanatical, you know, the people who are absolutely fanatical, but that their ideas are right and need to be spread, whether it's Jesus or paleo or veganism or CrossFit or whatever it is, right? People need to do this. They need to understand it. Otherwise, you know, they'll be worse off. So in a way that comes from a good place, right? And all the way down to people who are not quite as fanatical, but they believe quite strongly in their idea, and they're convincing enough that you get pulled along with them. Have you got any additional thoughts on that?
Well, very often the second group are consumers of the first group.
Hmm.
Right, like I've put myself in that second group so if I surround myself by enough people who share enough studies about veganism, about this being the one right way to eat.
Yeah.
Right. I've just like, well, look at the science. I mean, like I've written, you know, a bunch of books just collating the science, and I'm like, yeah, this is overwhelming.
Yeah.
And you know what, so the question is what may be missing in terms of, well, am I getting a balanced diet of information? And, you know, am I cherry picking?
Yeah. So therein lies the problem in the modern age, right? This has always been a problem. There's always been conflicting ideas and people that will tell you different points of view on a given thing, whether it's health or, you know, whether it's medicine. You'll have conflicting doctors in ancient Greece or ancient China. One of them will say, you know, that's leeches. Definitely leeches are the way forward. And somebody else will be like, just make him very cold for a long time, right? And they'll argue about it and you don't know who to believe. But now it seems like there's so many opinions and it's such a kind of dizzyingly information rich world that it can be hard to sift through all the wheat, you know, to sift the wheat from the chaff. Like there's so much chaff, you know, it's like it's crazy. So it's hard to even get started on that project sometimes. So I think we're using different rules of thumb. We're just kind of, we're relying a lot more, on kind of crowdsourcing our knowledge to an extent, right? Crowdsourcing, if it's highly prevalent on Facebook or Instagram, or it seems like somebody, you know, it's very, very popular with a good number of people who I kind of already trust, then good enough for me, right? And I'll run with that. I could go and read all the studies and I could go and look at alternative points of view and I could read all the meta-analyses and all the counter arguments and things like that. But Who has time for that shit, right? There's literally, even though we have access to all that stuff, we don't have to go to the library and learn the Dewey Decimal System anymore to pull these things out. Like, we could do it in a lot less time, but there's exponentially more information available on almost any subject. You know, it's hard to find a niche subject in which there aren't at least 12 opinions now, you know? So what additional problems does that pose? I mean, for you, let's get with a concrete example, right? You're fairly, or have been fairly convinced for a long time that, if not veganism, then whole food, plant-based eating is the most healthy diet that you can have, right? For a long period of time, that's been your bedrock, right? And that's a large part of your podcast. It's a large part of your health coaching practices, things like that as well. Deep down, how do you decide that that is true enough that you feel confident in being an authority in coaching other people in that?
Right. So I'd say a few things.
Yeah.
One is, I think it's very useful for me to publicly announce that I really don't know.
Mm.
Right. So there's always, like, even when you do the world's best random controlled trial with huge numbers,
mm-hmm.
you're still reporting confidence intervals. Right.
Sure. Mm.
So there's always an unknowability. And so I think that one of the things that I love about science, that pure scientific method, is that there's humility baked into it.
Mm-hmm. In theory.
Like, I don't know. Yeah, that's why I said pure. Like,
yeah,
Science versus scientists.
Yeah.
Right. So to say, like, I really believe this, but I could be wrong.
Mm.
Right. Like, there's people who will say, you know, the earth is flat and vaccines don't work and all this stuff, and they'll point to Galileo.
Yeah.
Right. Or Copernicus and say, see, people have believed bullshit for millennia. And so people are believing bullshit now.
Yeah.
And I think that's the wrong way to use that fact. But I think the right way to use it is to say, we really do need to be humble about what we know and what we don't know, which means, like, what does that mean? In terms of practice, it means it's very important to not live in your echo chamber.
Yeah.
It means you want to look for people who have different points of view and learn from them if you can. So very often I'll see an article and it'll say something that's the opposite of what I believe to be true, and I'll follow it. Now, most of the time it's, Facebook algorithm clickbait bullshit.
Yeah.
So, like, bacon is the fountain of youth, and the article is about.
Don't tell me it's not. You're shattering my reality.
Yeah, I should ease into this.
Yeah, I don't want to hear this truth.
Well, the study that I eventually found was that this type of a flatworm that's given supplemental niacin lives an average 11 days versus 10 days. And there's niacin in bacon.
Oh, wow. That's quite a stretch. That's elite.
So it wasn't too much of a stretch for baconbabe.com. But baconbabe then gets picked up by, some bigger blog, which then gets picked up eventually, and eventually it ends up in, like, a column on menshealth.com. Right. So But I didn't look at it just to debunk it and make fun of it, but to say, like, what do other people know? Like, there's enough people out there who are doing keto and paleo and Mediterranean and variations on those that look pretty good to me. They look pretty healthy, and they publish their blood work. And I'm like, well, maybe there's other ways to be healthy. Now, maybe long-term, those are bad. Right. There's a bunch of studies that seem to show that keto decreases lifespan. I believe that whole food plant-based is an optimal dietary pattern. I don't know if it's the optimal dietary pattern or the only one or the one for everyone. I honestly don't know.
So there's a couple of things in there that we'll come back to. First of all, that requirement for humility, right? So let's say you're looking at something. And you don't want to just kind of read it with the filter that you already know the truth in this. And so either this reinforces your existing truth and it says, here's another five reasons and another study why veganism rules and paleo sucks, right? And you read that article and you're like, yeah, I feel very affirmed and validated and one notch up today as an expert because I'm telling people this. And there it is, more evidence that this is true, right? And I might do the same thing with studies on breathing, right? A new study comes out that says, wow, the only real way to control yourself under stress, and there was one on the Huberman Lab podcast like a couple of months ago on this, and there was something else that was shared by some study at Stanford saying that, yeah, the only real way to get control of your stress response system, like in the moment, is controlled breathing. And then they went into one kind of tested method of controlled paced breathing that they did in the study and sort of said, this is, if not the, then a very, very strong method. And this absolutely works. And I'm like, wee, and I share this on my pages and all that kind of stuff. And I feel quite proud of myself because I talk so much about breathing and it's validated by, you know, quote, established science for once, and you do the same thing. But it takes a lot of humility to go from that to seeing something that says breathing doesn't matter. you can de-stress yourself with imagery, or you can de-stress yourself by organizing your house properly, Marie Kondo style or something, right? In your case, seeing something that really does seem to, maybe not bacon babe, but something a little bit more convincing, you know, seeing those kind of keto figures. And the problem with that is, again, right, you can draw up innumerable studies on whole food, plant-based eating, and even veganism, right? Well, let's just stick with whole food, plant-based, like as a whole. You can draw up tons and tons and tons of studies that show that you can recover from long-term illness sometimes when you go to whole food, plant-based. You can, you know, reverse the onset of diabetes. There's all kinds of things that you can do. But there are also studies that show that switching to kind of like a paleo diet or a keto diet can do the same thing, right? And the assertion that kind of, we don't know the long-term harm, maybe, you know, if you're, we do kind of know the long-term effects of being whole food plant-based in a sense, because we have societies and cultures that have done that for long periods and have been studied for long periods. And we've seen some of the transitions, like in the China study, something like that, right? So with fairly good confidence, you can say we've seen when this works in the wild, right? Not just in vitro or with a worm or something, right? We've seen whole populations of people try this. And then for some reason or another, they get shifted, like in the China study. And we've seen some of those effects. And so this is a fairly solid educated guess that here's how healthy they were before. Here's the new problems. Causative link, and we're fairly sure that there's long-term effects going on. But I think it's very hard to do the same thing for something like paleo or keto, because there just aren't long-term, really long-term studies of following somebody who's done a keto diet for like 30 or 40 years, and then a control population has eaten any other way in the same circumstance. You know what I mean? So it's, some of these things are too new. And so asserting that the long-term thing gives you damage is still extrapolating from small evidence in this. So making the same kind of mistake that bacon babe does in a way, but just like in a more subtle way. So it's not just the weight of evidence, right? It's not sufficient just to say there's lots of articles on this. There's lots of articles on this. It's who's writing those, like it's how it's written. It's the assumptions that are made in the experiment design. Even if your sole kind of measure for discerning the truth or untruth of anything is how close to the pure scientific method was this, it's still difficult, right? It's still very, very difficult. You can't rely on that as your one beacon. People say that you can, but you really can't, because of the human aspect, and because of the social aspect, and because of the financial aspect of how, you know, citations and papers are written and how people build scientific careers, right? And scientists themselves can be fanatical about what they're working on, and they present ideas above and beyond sometimes the usefulness of what they've actually found. Not everybody, and some are great. But again, now you have to discern between who are the good ones and who aren't. So even within, like, okay, everybody, these people are using what I think is the scientific method, you're still making a value judgment on who you trust, aren't you? At some point, it just comes down to, did somebody I trust say so? And that really is the metric that we usually use.
Right? Yeah, and I think it's very hard to, as you know, for scientists, for good, ethical, caring scientists who are searching for the truth, and not fall into the trap of extending over their skis, or right. And you know, I've seen this with people who, you know, depending on how quickly they kind of get slapped back to reality. Mm. You know, some of the people I'm thinking of are Amy Cuddy, who gave that TED talk on body, you know, power poses.
Oh, not aware of that one.
So she, it's like one of the like the top two or three TED Talks ever. So basically that, you know, if you assume a power pose and let the audio record show that I'm like, you know, sort of like Superman, arms out, you know, chest up, looking up.
End scene of Platoon.
That, you know, that makes people more confident. It makes them, you know, in studies and in behavioral studies, they are more assertive and like turning off the fan, the annoying fan, things like that. And their like IgA levels in saliva change, demonstrate. And this was like, this was the research. And, you know, all of a sudden, like, oh, great. So women can equalize their power positions in corporate America by assuming power poses. And that was the talk. And then it turns out nobody's able to replicate it. And her own lab didn't really replicate it. And they compared not power poses versus neutral, but power poses versus the opposite, fetalizing.
Okay.
Right. And that's how they got, like the idea was so seductive.
So hang on, just to clarify. So they, so in Amy Cuddy's study, the one that she was drawing from, they weren't comparing power pose with no pose. They were comparing power pose with fetalizing, right?
Right, right.
That's fascinating from our point of view, because we know, or we believe, right, that fetalizing has net effects that are detrimental towards those kinds of behaviors. Like we could predict that it would go the other way, that you're actually creating a negative balance there. So that's about the furthest thing from a control that you could have created. That's very interesting.
Yeah, and you know, and she came under a ton of criticism. You know, again, this is about humans, and a lot of it was very nasty, right? You know, and sexist and derogatory. And she kind of, you know, like left the public eye for a while. I think he probably had to go recover, like just spiritually. And then there's also, you know, Brian Wansink, who did the work on mindless eating. He has a book, Mindless Eating.
Okay.
And in my impeccable timing, I had him on the podcast. And he basically talks about like the bigger, you know, if you have a big plate, you'll eat more.
Sure.
If you have a bigger spoon, you'll eat more. And he did these experiments with
the bottomless bowl.
Bottomless bowl, or, you know, or stale popcorn in a movie versus stale popcorn in a lab setting. The week I published my podcast interview with him, he was basically like censured and thrown off the faculty at Cornell for fabricating results. So, you know, so I don't know the truth of any of this. This is like, you know, he said, she said, they both seem like really nice people. But I think they both had an idea that seduced them beyond, beyond the evidence. And, you know, and so I think the, I think there's a, there must be some sort of a discipline for science to say, I've got to go actively search out
counterfactuals or things that might
You know, so a great example of this, you know, Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who, you know, are intellectual heroes with behavioral economics.
Thinking Fast and Slow, in the book.
Yeah, if there was another guy, Gary Klein was saying, no, this is not how it works. And they got together and they did studies together. Because like, hey, we totally disagree on this.
Yeah.
But, you know, the three of them were such pure scientists. They're like, what's going on?
Yeah.
What, why are we disagree?
Yeah.
And they, you know, and they discovered nuance. Like, ah, in this situation, this, in this other situation, that.
Yeah. See, that's beautiful. And that's what we want to believe most of science is built around, that people look for ways to disprove their own theory. But human nature holds that it just isn't such, right? And that gets into like an interesting thing of like what we want to be true versus what is true and what can be true. And that, we'd love that to happen all the time. But being realistic, people, scientists being people, aren't going to do that, I don't think, for the most part. And so the bulk of science is not being done in that way. It's being done by people who have an idea, they become attached to that idea, they test that idea. If it doesn't work out, maybe they'll drop it. But if for them, they've proved something, and they've succeeded in making some little dent in the pantheon of knowledge, right? Then that's theirs now. And they're going to build on that to get more funding. They're going to build on that to get more work, to hire other people to support their lab full of postdocs, whatever it's going to be, right? So if somebody comes along and challenges that, the response is not like, oh, that's fascinating. Let me do work with you and we'll both figure out why my thing might be wrong and I should not be funded anymore. Do you know what I mean? It's not typically the way that things go. Normally they circle the wagons and just defend right down to the last man, right? Alamo style. Although apparently at the Alamo, most of the people walked out and surrendered and got executed anyway. So that's a myth. But you know, the idea is that the idea kind of doesn't survive contact with reality. The idea that science is done in this impersonal, dispassionate way really does. So that you telling that story is almost like it's beautiful and it's lovely because we kind of know that that's not really, not usually the way that it goes. Right?
And I think there's a bigger problem, which is to be a scientist and to get funding, you have to be the star quarterback.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not going to be the offensive or defensive lineman, the grunt workers, which means you're, you know, like what we need in science is duplication of results.
Yeah.
Right? And we don't get that. So there's a study. And it says something really weird and amazing. And everyone's like, oh, wow, like this is the new thing, right? Because it's more interesting.
Yeah.
Like if I sent you an article that says broccoli is good for you, you might not open the link. If I sent you an article that says, you know, Krispy Kreme donuts are good for you, you're like, what? Right? So it's just our brains going like, oh, novelty.
Yeah, because we filter for surprise. Like we, you know, surprise is a something that we crave. Like. Yeah.
So if most of science is not attempting to replicate results, how trustworthy is any of it?
Yeah. And that point about the power poses to, you know, people feeling more confident and things like that, that speaks to a larger problem in psychology, I think, which has been called, you know, the replication crisis, right? That that so many of these findings, especially in psychology papers from like the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, right? And now people are going back through and trying to replicate them and can't. Like it's something like, I don't know what the figure is. I think something like 90% of them cannot be replicated when they designed the study the way that the people said that they did, which means that you start to believe, how true is this stuff? And it's shaky at best. But that seems to me to be weighted in a big, big way towards psychology, and in which studies are very, very difficult to constrain and design in such a way that they're not open to those problems. But it's by no means completely restricted to that, right? It's very, very easy to design a nutrition study or even a double blind control study that does nothing but prove that's what happens when you do this kind of double blind control study that hasn't really proved what they think it's proving as it goes outside of it. So it's a problem that there is a bit of a crisis, but again, I don't know whether the weight of evidence argument is sufficient for us to solve the problem, because that's not really what we do, right? We certainly can't acquire all the knowledge by ourselves, right? We certainly can't do all the research and do all the experiments and run all the PCR tests and, you know, interview all the people. If we tried to do that, and I think there was an article in Medium a while back about how do we discern truth from reality, and it might have been in relation to the vaccine, anti-vaccine movement, things like that. But one of the points that it was making in there was that the quest to kind of be a sole discerner of knowledge, right? To just be like, I don't trust the government. I don't trust scientists. I don't trust nutritionists. I don't trust health coaches or martial arts instructors, right? The only thing that's true is what I know for myself. And that's absolute fallacy. It's absolutely impossible to discern truth in any useful way that way. Because you're limited to what you can experience yourself. And moreover, you're marking yourself as the sole arbiter of what knowledge can be, right? With the limits of your knowledge and the limits of your powers of discernment and judgment, you are deciding that the only knowledge exists is essentially the knowledge that I know and judge to be true already, which means you can essentially never learn anything new, or you can only really delude yourself as to whether or not something. So truth becomes personal judgment, and that's it, right? So all of these people that say that I don't trust the government, I don't trust scientists, I don't trust at all, if they refuse to recognize any kind of expertise or authority or kind of collective wisdom, if they're doing that and they're trying to be on their own, then they're setting themselves up immediately for disappointment. You know that they're going to be straying as far, very, very far from logic, very, very far from reason, very, very far from actually what's what reality is. And you know, we can get into deep philosophical ideas of what even is reality. It's something we all agree on. But it's almost the opposite of what Tyson Yoka Porter talks about, you know, in his like cultural collective knowledge and an indigenous knowledge, in which knowledge really is, like reality really is what the tribe creates and what everybody agrees is true. And you can't know anything in a vacuum. And that's absolutely true in a practical sense, right? If we don't trust any scientists, we don't trust anybody in the government, we don't trust anybody at all, then you're just a yokel in a hut making value judgments for yourself. And you can't claim, you cannot claim that you know everything. You can't. You'd have to be omnipotent to be able to make that claim.
Well, and listen, I just ordered the book, The Extended Mind.
Yeah.
By Annie Murphy Paul, who makes that point. Like, our brains evolved for a particular purpose.
Yeah.
Right. And the purpose is to sort of navigate outdoor space and social interactions.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so we have biases towards that that are very evolutionarily advantageous to do what everyone around us is doing.
Yeah.
Right. Whether they're right or not.
Yeah.
Right. So I was talking with Josh Lajani, you know, yesterday about, you know, him being a progressive in a MAGA world down in South Louisiana. And like, how easy is it for people in that community to all be MAGA? To all be flying, you know, the vaccines are a hoax, government conspiracy flag, because it's more important for our survival to be in agreement with our tribe than to be right.
Yeah, or on the flip side, if you're in a community in, you know, Oregon or Seattle or something like that, or you know, middle of New York, where everybody is talking about nothing but, you know, critical race theory or other stuff like that. If you're the one person who's just like, yeah, I don't care that much about critical race theory, it's quite hard. it will be difficult to go against the grain of those people, like the super liberals as well. So it doesn't matter which chamber you're in. Do you know what I mean? It's harder to resist. It's harder to kind of be the nail that sticks up and probably will get hammered down than it is to go with the flow. That's absolutely true. Yeah.
So, I mean, for myself, one of the things I think about is, like, maybe I don't need to find the truth. Maybe I just need to find good enough.
Yeah. So this is an absolute question that I wanted to get to, right? So if it's never about finding absolute truth, and it's only about finding truth that's good enough for now, and there are actually lots of philosophies of science that say that that's all that science is anyway, right? Scientists will talk about theories and hypotheses and laws. And by the time something becomes a law, then that's it. It's a fact. It's like, but real philosophers of science will tell you there's no such thing as a scientific fact. There's only a highly corroborated theory, right? That's it. And it can be extraordinarily highly corroborated. But then what does corroborated mean? It means that lots of people that you trust, because somebody said they're scientists or they got their degree at Stanford or whatever it's going to be, have agreed on that idea. So ultimately, you're still crowdsourcing your constitution of knowledge, right? Your constitution of knowledge is still dependent on expertise. It's dependent on trust. That trust leaves holes that enable people to exploit us if they want to, right? If we do trust people and they're not trustworthy or they're, you know, charlatans or something like that, then that's the whole. So there's the dichotomy, right? It's really, really tough. You have to weigh that up all the time. It's like you can't know. So how do you decide not whether something is true, but is good enough for you? So let's give it a concrete example, because otherwise we can get into like a philosophy discussion here and everybody will get very bored, right? Let's take a recent example. So the Herman Ponsa book, The Burn, how exercise and calories really work. I can't remember the exact title of the book.
Yeah.
Something like that, right? Burn, how what was the real lid story off? About how calories.
Some marketer got their hand on the cover.
Something like that. Right?
Close the lid off. Yeah.
Yeah. So essentially, it's right now, I mean, this is an idea that's been around for about a decade, but it's not scientific establishment, right? It's not something that everybody agrees on. I mean, nutrition is tricky anyway. But can you give us an overview of what his view is and why it's controversial, why the book would be controversial at all with anybody in the dieting world?
Well, he says that we basically have a calorie constraint model, that that our bodies burn roughly the same amount of calories every day on average. Not that if you run a marathon one day, but on average, men burn about 3,000 calories a day, women a little north of 2,000. And when you exercise, you're not adding to that. We're just shifting a caloric burn from other things.
Right. So to clarify, in the short term, we're not saying that if you run a marathon or like, you know, do high intensity interval training for 2 hours today, that you will not burn more energy, that you will not use more energy. We're not saying that. We're just saying in the short term, that might happen. But if you're looking at exercise as a way of burning off energy, right, that you eat via food and therefore you can eat more food and then just exercise more and burn it off, it doesn't work, in at least in the long term. We know that it doesn't work. And the formative example, the one that stuck in my head from your interview with him, I haven't read the book yet, and it's fascinating, but is this idea that he gets this from studying Hadzi tribesmen in, is it Tanzania or Kenya? Something like that.
Hadzi tribesmen in northern Tanzania.
Tanzania, yeah, who have very active, they move as much in a day as most Americans do in like a week and a half or something like that, right? It's all day hunting and gathering, building and dancing and doing stuff, right? Versus sedentary American, right? And they both have, after time, like as a net average over time, they have about the same energy expenditure per day. It's that like 3,000 calories or whatever, you know, energy equivalent is going to be. It's like, how can you account for that if one of them is moving so much more than the other one? And it's that the person that's moving, their bodies have just adjusted to that over time. That becomes the new normal. And they're taking energy from other systems. And in the Hadzi's case, that's actually quite beneficial because it pulls energy away from an overactive immune system, right? Or overactive other places. But in the sedentary American's case, without that exercise, right? Yeah, then they're not putting on weight because they're not exercising. They're putting on weight because they're eating a ton, right? More than their bodies actually need, not just for movement, but for everything. And those, that energy has to go somewhere. And that other, that energy that's not being spent by the Hadzi and it, but by them in the sense in exercise, is put towards the immune system, it being overreactive and elevated inflammatory response and the stress response as well, which is very, very relevant to me in my work in stress proofing as well. So this kind of idea that there's kind of, yeah, there's ups and there's downs in the short term, but if you're looking at long-term strategies for eating and exercising, you should exercise, but not to lose weight, because that's not what happens. There's a trade-off, right? And there's a fixed energy budget. And sooner or later, your body will just take energy from other systems, not from your fat cells.
Right. And, you know, and I asked him, like, why would our bodies, like, assume we don't exercise, why are our bodies so stupid that they're sort of ramping up immune response when it becomes counterproductive and inflammatory? Why do we have this heightened stress response? Like, what would be the, why, you know, our bodies aren't stupid. Why are they acting so stupidly? He's like, well, if you think about it, that would be a rare occurrence in the old days to have all this extra energy. We would then, you know, you think, oh, go fix the house, go do this, go do all the stuff you can't afford to do. Like, oh, let's go scavenge. Let's go, you know, let's make sure there's no threats around, because it was the body assumes that's going to be a very short term windfall.
Sure. Yeah. Having a surplus of food available was not the norm, right? For 100,000 years of our existence. And probably right up until about a couple of hundred years ago, right? Most people didn't have a surplus of food, right? Famine was pretty common right up until the 1800s, you know, like pretty much, right? So it's only been a little while that famine, I mean, of course, some places you still get famine, but not the way that it used to be. It used to be an annual occurrence in most places in the world. There used to be famines in New York right up until about, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, I think. So so that's a big deal. It's our bodies are still, and it's this narrative about our modern bodies and brains acting for a time in which they are now ill-adapted, you know, like the modern world has changed, modern food has changed, modern information has changed, and they're trying to do something that fit perfectly in archaic Tanzania, but doesn't work too well in, you know, modern day Durham, North Carolina.
And the reason this, you know, this theory is so upsetting to people,
yeah,
is because it contradicts The Biggest Loser, right? Which is our current cultural model of weight loss, which is near starvation and work out brutally like 8 hours a day.
Sure.
And get shamed for getting tired and giving up.
Right? Yeah, so, or that it suggests, or there's any suggestion at all that exercise isn't beneficial for everything. Do you know what I mean? For the exercise fanatics, for the people who are like, exercise is everything. If you're like, yeah, you should exercise. It helps with your stress response. It helps with your inflammatory response. It's not going to keep the weight off in the long term. That's all about nutrition. But you should still exercise. Even saying that will have people spitting out their tea, you know, spitting out their lattes or whatever it's going to be. You know, it's stabbing them right in their orthodoxy, isn't it? Like getting straight in there as well. Right. So for you, so I want to bring that concrete example, right? I heard that idea and I'm like, that's fascinating. And that equates to me to the idea of kind of like a fixed neurological budget, and that things have to get pulled around. And if you get very stressed out, it will pull energy the other way, right? Away from digestion, and it will pull energy away from repair and all of it, immunity, all of those things as well. So for me, I'm like, yeah, this kind of makes sense. I want to learn more about it. I haven't read the book yet, and I haven't fully kind of folded it into my other concepts of what surrounds nutrition and exercise and everything else, right? There's some points of conflict that I haven't quite dealt with yet. Like what happens in terms of strength training? Because it's absolutely clear that, you know, when you eat a lot of food and it's built as muscle, not aerobic exercise, which is mostly what he was talking about. But when you gain, you know, muscle, then that muscle requires more nutrition. You do eat more food. It's just displaced in a different way. What happens there? Is there an adaptation to that over time? And how does that compare to aerobics? And then also,
he has an answer for that, by the way.
He does. Okay, interesting. Yeah, and I'd love to talk. So is it a short answer, or is it a
very short answer? You burn calories based on your weight.
Okay, so
when you weigh more, you burn more calories.
Okay, so there is an additional energy requirement just because your weight goes up anyway. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. Because you're slugging more around all day long and that stuff. Right. Yeah. Okay. That's fine. And that makes sense. Right. And that's one way of resolving those. But there's other things in between as well, which is, and this has been my general kind of issue with the straight calories in, calories out model in the past. It's not that that's not true. It's not true that if you create an energy deficit, like by eating less than your standard, whether or not it's a fixed energy budget or one that fluctuates, if you eat less than that, then of course, right, you're going to create a deficit and you will probably lose weight that way, right? Do you know what I mean? But my problem is that basically it's a truism, right? It's an obvious truism, but it sidesteps psychology entirely. It just says then all you have to do is eat less calories, right? Which is actually the problem. the problem isn't that people don't know that they have an energy budget, and if only they knew this, then everything would change. It's just like, what do you have to do in order to consistently create that deficit? And so out of that come all of the potential diet solutions that people see, whether it's keto, whether it's going vegetarian to avoid fatty foods, if they're not ethical for it, or whether it's, you know, intermittent fasting or wherever it's going to be. It's like, and it might be that all of these things only work on the energy deficit model, right? But some of them work better with human psychology than others. And that's not something he addresses. He just says, oh, they're all fads and you just have to eat less food. It's just like, who cares? We're human beings and we have to figure out. And this is assuming that his view is absolutely true, right? I'm forced to kind of move my models around to fit that based on what's true. Right now, there's not a big conflict in my head. And the status that I've assigned Ponce's theory in my head is that, yeah, good enough. Yeah, I probably believe that. Right. For you, how did you arrive at good enough for Ponce's theory, given that it probably conflicted with other things that you know about too? Like he said to you, there's not really any benefit to eating a raw food diet and you can't really thrive on it. Do you know what I mean? And there's problems with veganism. He said things like that. And you probably like, there's something in you bristling, like there's some knowledge, there's some base in there that's being stabbed. How did you arrive at, yeah, good enough, I believe that now?
Uh-huh. Well, so one thing, I mean, I'll start with the externals. He's a professor at Duke University.
Okay.
That's a plus in my mind. Like, I feel like he's gone through a bunch of hurdles. He's probably not a nut.
Yeah.
He's probably not a faker.
So expertise and trust again. Yeah. Trust and expertise.
Then I go and I look at who praised his book. And I look them up. Mm-hmm. And I was like, who are his friends? Who are his friends on Twitter? Are they interested in truth? Are they publishing, you know, links to studies like, oh, look at this, this is interesting? Or are they hardcore, you know, are they nasty? Like, honestly, like, you know, there's a group of plant-based doctors and researchers that I've been following on Twitter who are very critical of the icons of the vegan movement. You know, critical of Dr. Esselstyn, Dr. Campbell, Dr. Barnard, Dr. McDougall, saying that they're basically quacks because they don't believe in science anymore. They've just got an idea and they're following. And they're like, that's really interesting because these are plant-based doctors. They're not keto, but they're saying we are the ones who are maintaining science. And you know, their motto is like RCT or go to hell, meaning randomized clinical trial, or don't even talk to me about it. And it was very interesting, but I had to stop following them because they were nasty.
Okay, but does that make them incorrect though? Why is nastiness like a but it's an interesting thing because you have to ask, like, if they're being really nasty and defensive about their belief, what are they afraid of? That's the question that I ask myself, right?
Right. Like, so nastiness means that their ego is primary.
Yeah. Here.
It's, to me, it's just, it's a tell.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, the people that I have met who have been the most gracious around this, when you argue with them, they say, wow, that's really interesting. Can you send me a paper on that? I would love to look that up. I never heard of that.
Yeah.
Or, oh, I didn't really, you know, and it's disarming.
So that's a rule of thumb. That's a little algorithm that you've come up with, right? If somebody's nasty and aggressive, they're probably afraid of something, hiding something, or attached to their ego. That doesn't bode well for their ability to discern truth, right? Or their trustworthiness. Therefore, if Herman Ponser had come on your podcast and he'd been really aggressive with you, right? Even if he was saying all the same things with all the same people recommending him, with all the same research, and in your mind, all of the same logical parallels being drawn, if he'd have been on there being like, no, that's not what it is at all. And that's why people who are vegans are just idiots, you know, would you have believed his theory to the same extent? Probably not, right?
Yeah. And it might be my problem, but I also want to live a happy, like, compassionate life. So like, you know, I wrote these books back in the day that were very aggressive in promoting a perspective and saying that other perspectives are wrong.
Sure.
And, you know, I tried to make a career out of that. And I found that it just didn't fit my personality. Like, I'm not a debater.
Yeah.
I'm not a fighter. I, you know, can't we all just get along?
Sure. Yeah. But I, to be clear, I'm not like kind of saying, oh, that's a bad a yardstick by which to measure truth. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that's actually a valid yardstick for measuring truth. But that's also about acknowledging that what you're doing is not coldly assessing the science and assessing his professorship as a Duke professor. More important in some ways than the fact that he is a Duke professor is that he is a calm, benign, and non-egotistical Duke professor. Do you see what I mean? So that's actually the quality that you've latched onto and said, okay, because of that, I'll listen to him to a greater extent than I want. So it's still about this discernment of people that you trust, right? And it might be somebody who's in an expert position. You might be like, oh, he's an expert. That's good enough for me. A lot of Americans are, in my experience, distrustful of expertise or authority generally, right? In a way that we're not in Europe, in a funny way, like a lot of people aren't in Europe. So a lot of people go to the next thing down, which is it a very trusted friend or family member? Is it somebody who I feel is just very trustworthy? Or this other kind of category that I kind of came up with, that it's a person that you feel to be a combination of unusually wise, right, through like acquired knowledge, whether that's academic or life experience living in India and millions of places or wherever it's going to be, and that you feel this fundamentally incapable of deception, that you're like, there's nothing to me that would suggest that they want to hoodwink me or something, right? If you find those two things in a person, it's very powerful, isn't it? For me, it is anyway. And I'm much more inclined to listen to them and give weight to their ideas than I am somebody else who's authoritative, but shifty and nasty. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, so it's I'm thinking of Sam Harris. You know, I think he's a very intelligent guy. He has guests on the show. I listen to it all the time. I think he brings up really relevant issues that need to be discussed. But sometimes the way that he discusses them, to me, suggests that he needs to be right. And that he, do you know what I mean? And he can shoot people down if they don't agree with his ideas and things like that. And I'm like, okay, well, I believe you to a point, but I might believe somebody else in your kind of oeuvre, right? Somebody else who's also like a thinker, a dark web guy or something, but who's not so vehement about it. Do you know what I mean? Who is going like, that's interesting. I want to read the study on that. You know, I'm more inclined to believe those than I am him, even though he does represent a source of knowledge for me, right? But it's not the source, but it's the same yardstick I'm using, right? I'm like, how much ego is invested? And is that a warning sign as to what else is coming on? What other baggage is coming with this knowledge?
Yeah. Yeah, something else I just realized is, and I haven't read Byrne yet, but he is a historian of his field. And I think that's very important for me, that someone is a historian of their field, that they're not just deeply knowledgeable about this moment, about this body of knowledge. So he's talking about something that I frankly don't understand at all, which is like double water measuring of caloric expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing with an isotope and you measure the P and you do like, you know, maybe in 11th grade, I could have done it as like a math problem, but like now I'm like, I, you know what? Okay. So he says, like, this is the gold standard for measurement, and here's why. And I'm like, okay. But he goes through the history of how we measure calories. Mm-hmm. And he knows his field, and he understands, okay, here were the previous standards, and here's how the new ones compare to those, and here's why there's why we believe there's greater validity and reliability to these measures.
So is there an aspect of transparency there as well? The more transparent somebody is, the more they show their work, right? more you're inclined to believe them as well. But if they're hiding something and being like, trust me, it's true, don't ask, then there's a different thing.
Well, even, I mean, I don't know scientists who are like, I'm not going to show my work. But whether, it's an attempt to understand it.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the things that I found really appealing about Hermann Panzer is how much he values people like you who are explainers. Mm. Right. So right before he was on my podcast, he was on Alan Alda's podcast. Mm. And he's like, I love Alan Alda. Of course, you know, I fanboyed him from MASH, but he's such a good SciComm explainer. And so like Hermann Panzer, like he does his best to explain what double water is. Like, I want you to understand why I use this method and why I think it's so great and why we got this wrong in the past, right? Okay. He's saying, I have a new theory. It blows the lid off of old theories. And it's not because I'm brilliant. It's because we have better tools and we use them in a different way. And I was so lucky to have access to this primate lab and to these people. And
Okay, so he offers a lot of weight coming with his argument, and that comes to the old idea that if you present an unusual viewpoint, right, one that's contradictory, then it requires unusual evidence, which is not always fair. Like sometimes you're like, oh man, we can't get this, we can't do the experiment design yet, or for various reasons we can't do this yet, and we could hark back to Galileo and all kinds of stuff in astronomy for that, but that holds true all the time. So, but it's not bad, right? If somebody tells you that they can levitate. Right. If somebody tells you that they can lose weight, they can lose 10 pounds in a week, then I'd be like, yeah, that's probably true. I see boxers do it all the time, with weight cutting and stuff like that. But if somebody tells you they can levitate, I'm not going to believe you unless you present me with some pretty compelling evidence, like nothing short of me seeing you fly. And even then I'll be looking for wires and squatting underneath you and stuff like that. You're going to have to give me some pretty compelling evidence for that unusual claim. Right. And so I think that's a fair thing to hold in your head. Right. So let's go to another couple of quick concrete examples just to kind of round this off. And one is Porges versus Huberman, right? So we had a little exchange in which you were saying that Andrew Huberman on his podcast, The Huberman Lab, which I think is great too, he has some really, really good stuff on there, was somewhat disparaging the polyvagal theory movement. Not saying that the theory itself was bullshit, but just that it's been extended, they're over their skis, that lots of people are making claims as to its diagnostic capacity or its therapeutic capacity that aren't really demonstrated by what he said. And he suggested the holes that he's knocking in it. And actually Porges acknowledges this in the updated versions of his book as well, is that anatomists. If you don't know what polyvagal theory is, we've had like another podcast on it and things. And Stephen Porges was on an earlier episode, but essentially it's saying that it's not just fight or flight versus rest and digest. And that you have, two branches to your autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, which is what's always taught in textbooks. And that's the way it goes. It's medical orthodoxy. But there are actually kind of two functional branches. And this is the key word, I think, functional branches to the parasympathetic nerve and its function, the ventral and the dorsal, meaning in front and behind. And he says that the ones kind of associated, one set are associated with kind of social engagement and like positive calming yourself down, associated with eye movement, facial expressions, lots of other things. And the other one is associated with like a deep kind of shutdown, right? And there's an interplay which leads to a spectrum of stress responses, right? Not just fight or flight or rest and digest, but a spectrum of things, including kind of engagement and stimulation, social engagement, somewhere between fight or flight and shutdown, lots and lots of little things, which adds a lot of diagnostic capacity and seem to explain a lot more of the clinical obvious data, behavioral data that he was seeing. And then in the book, and in his writings, he kind of extrapolates to animal evolution and physiology and neonatal development, all kinds of things, right? So there seems to be a lot that goes into it. And it's been a powerful idea that lots of therapists have used, and I've used it, and it seems to segue very well with lots of systema thinking, with other viewpoints on stress and the body, even from like Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, things like that. It seems to be a very powerful unifying idea. But Hoopman's problem with it is, one, when anatomists look for the two branches of the nerve, it doesn't quite work out that way. Like, it doesn't physically look that way in the body, right? Therefore, it's not quite true. The basis, what he's basing things on, that there's physically a branch like that, isn't quite true. It's more like a loop, or it doesn't quite go the way that we say it is. And two, even if it is true to some extent, and it's useful in some areas, saying that if somebody has hypermobile joints, it's probably because they have a poor vagal tone or something like that, or poor control over their sympathetic autonomic response, dysautonomia, something like that, is going too far. That they might just have hypermobility because they have shitty joints or bad nutrition, or they've injured themselves or something like that, right? So to your point, so how do you then decide whether or not Huberman has said, blast that out of the water, and maybe I shouldn't believe Porges anymore, and that's no longer something that's important to me? Or is Porges still good enough, but Huberman's just pointed out the edges of what defines good enough?
Yeah, so I think, when I think about it, is something true? So one of them is there a mechanism?
Mm-hmm.
Right, like, do we know, like, does it make sense? Like, oh, we have this thing in our body that does mm-hmm. this. We know that, sucrose is converted to ATP. So yeah. That makes sense, whatever.
Yeah.
Right. So like, if there's no mechanism, then we have to then like, well, I don't see how that could be true or why it would be. Right.
So but that's a big statement, because we find things all the time, and we make, we didn't know what the mechanism was for penicillin, for example, but we just found that there was something that funguses make that kill bacteria, and we used it successfully to cure half the world of infectious diseases. And we didn't have a mechanism for years, and we didn't have a mechanism of how mental activity affects the body via stress for a long time. We just empirically saw that it was true, but there was no direct mechanism, or there were woolly mechanisms, wrong mechanisms. Darwin famously thought that genes blended together and came out with offspring, instead of like in the digital way that they are inherited, and there's dominance and recession and crossovers and differential gene activation. Like, he had no idea how genes worked. He just knew there was something heritable, but the wide sweep of his theory is still true. It's just false in some areas, right? So you can have something very useful and true to an extent without knowing the exact mechanism, right?
Right. It was just, that's one area. So
yeah.
That's one of the things I look for.
Is
there a known mechanism? If not, then, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof.
Okay.
A second is sort of an evolutionary filter. Like, if that were true, would you and I be alive to have this conversation today?
That's an interesting one. That's a good one. Yeah.
Right. So I think about that in terms of, people's propensity to put on fat. Like, if we didn't, or if we needed, if we needed animal protein every day and it was a requirement, would you and I be alive to have this conversation based on human history? Like, probably not. Like, if we couldn't go a day without, oxygen, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Protein, no.
Right.
So that, just as a, another filter. But for me, the most important filter is like, what I learned from about science is that the test of a theory is its predictive ability.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So does this, so for Ponser's theory about burn, who I've talked to who are like, oh my God, that makes so much sense, is former fat people. Right. So I had the conversation with Josh Lajani, who lost 230 pounds. I was like, absolutely. That's exactly my experience. And I didn't understand it.
Yeah.
We're talking to a bunch of other people like, yeah, I was exercising. I changed my diet. I lost all this weight. I exercised more and I couldn't get it off. Does this theory, predict what I, does it help me get what I want? Does it help our society achieve what it wants?
Yeah.
Whether it's absolutely true or not. So for me, the good enough is, can I predict an eclipse with it? Does it work? Can I predict, the effects of an economic policy on economic theory? So I think that's the best we can do. And, so Newton was wrong, right, about Newtonian physics, but it still works well for basketball.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and then just to tie this off with a vague reference to Sistema, since we've been talking for like an hour with mostly just about vague philosophy and then health and nutrition and things. It's like the question that popped into my head with this one is like the ongoing argument all the time about slow and soft work in Systema, and whether that has validity in real combative fighting arts, right? Like, why do we spend so much time working soft? Why do we at all ever be compliant as training partners? Why aren't we just giving it full tilt all the time so that the other person can see what works with full tilt all the time? And there's kind of two camps in that, right? You've got it's like Systema versus wrestling versus MMA. And like the wrestling MMA crowd are kind of like, well, look who's in the cage. Look who's wrestling and doing really well and fighting well in the MMA cage. That proves who can do it and who can't, right? and that's what works. But interestingly, there's other, and the Systema camp or the traditional martial arts camp might say, yeah, but that's not what it's designed for. And look what happens when, you know, MMA fighters get into knife fights or what, when they get set upon by two or three people, they move in very sloppy ways that don't help them and they're less likely to survive. So we're training for something different than a linear back and forward attack. And also, you know, capacities for escape and all kinds of stuff like that. But interestingly, there's also some wriggle room in the middle in which people training things like Brazilian jiu-jitsu or even boxing, right, will do light sparring or light rolling, right? They'll agree not to go full force and full speed so that they can feel things out, learn new techniques, practice new combinations, study distance and timing, you know, all of these things. And nobody denigrates Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioners or boxers when they do that. They're not like, why the hell isn't Mike Tyson going full tilt on his trainer there, his elderly trainer? Why isn't he smashing him in the face, doing all these things, right? It's so it seems as a means to an end, as long as the end result is powerful. I think that's what it is. And so for me, that argument about soft work and things, it's like, well, okay.
Can you just define soft and slow work? Because I'm going to put this on my podcast and people will not understand.
Gotcha. Okay. So so if you think of like maybe a boxer in a full boxing match or a wrestler in a wrestling match, right? Obviously both people are typically trying about as hard as they can, right? They're going about as fast as they can. They're using all the power that they can. They're delivering as much damage or as much power as they can in a short time in order to try and win a contest, right? And that's necessary to an extent, right? If you're trying to win a contest and that's the motivation. But if you think of a boxer just softly, just kind of shadow boxing, not throwing everything with massive power, but just kind of jabbing their hand out there, slipping, weaving, moving in kind of smaller ways, or even just practicing the mechanics of a punch, just sending it out slowly, bringing it back so that they can feel what's going on. Or you can imagine a wrestler slowly going through the motions of a new and complex throw or something like that, right? Those things exist in those arts, and they're looked at as training tools to get you up to the place that they will help you to compete. With the intermediary step of like, let's spar a bit faster, let's spar a little bit harder. And then, but nobody spars full tilt ahead of a match, because you'll injure yourself and then, you know, or get knocked out, and then you won't be up for the match itself, right? So there are always gradations of this. In Systema, we do more of this than is typical, I would say. We spend more of our time in this slow kind of shadow boxing, matching, timing, blending type space, with a view to developing more kind of neurological skill versus outward power and external power and things like that, right? So that's what it is. So you can think of it somewhere between kind of martial arts drill practice, like if he does this and you do this, and something like contact improv. You know, it's like there's a dance-like element to it, right? There's an ability to flow around each other and feel what's going on and feel sensitivity to pressure, which is hard to do at speed. Not impossible, but it's hard to do at speed, right? So you have to learn it this way. That's the idea. Does that kind of sum it up?
Yeah. And so the idea is that the mixed martial arts people are looking down at Systema because they've seen a couple of YouTube videos of Vladimir,
yeah,
and they say, well, that's not real.
Or they're just like, well, where's the result? Where's my people doing it, even without training with people or something like that? And again, where people fall down on this, or where people, which side of the fence they fall on as to whether or not it's useful or not, and whether they stay with the training or not, seems to come down to these same kind of yardsticks, right? They're like, okay, first, let's see if somebody I trust has done this, right? So I saw somebody who's a grandmaster of like Arnis fighting, like stick fighting in the Philippines. And he's a Silat practitioner. He's a brilliant martial artist in his own field, highly respected, has never done Systema, but watched a video of one of our high level guys, Martin Wheeler, moving softly around people and then working into things. And just saying, this is superb. This reflects so many things that we train. Most people can't understand what they're looking at here. And as a result, a lot of other people were like, yeah, I should look into this guy. You know, so the authority of this guy that, you know, somebody or Dan Inosanto, like, or Higgin Machado, and another recognized figures in martial arts, professing, saying you really should train with Vladimir, or you really should train with Martin. He has a transcendent ability that you need to know about, right? That lends weight because people put trust in them. So again, it's an authority figure that people know that they can trust. And then it's kind of crowdsourced, right? And so you have this crowd of martial artists on something like Bullshido.net who will all agree whether or not they agree whether or not something is real, you know? And on the basis of that, some people will read those and then be like, oh, I guess I'm not going to do Taekwondo then, or I'm not going to do Sistema, or maybe Krav Maga is the one for me, right? It's just kind of, it's the constitution of knowledge by public opinion, right? And again, like everything else, this is extrapolated and pushed out by social media and people arguing with each other and that kind of thing. But it seems like the same thing. So how do I agree on whether or not the truth of the validity and the efficacy of soft work and the way of training that we do in Sistema is good enough for me, right? Do I know that it's 100% true and that it's 100% the best way of training and all the other ways of training are not true? No, I don't. And I don't claim to. All I know is that I've seen and felt people who I know and trust who have had to use their skills in real live environments, in very, very dangerous law enforcement or military environments or security environments. They're extraordinarily stable under pressure. They're extraordinarily calm people. And something about this methodology builds those, right? Versus other people that I talk to who are very, very skilled fighters, but are very nervous, anxious people who always seem to get into fights and who always seem to be limping, right? They're always injured all times. They just seem to find ways to damage themselves before they even get in the fights with other people, right? So I look at that and the authority thing. And in the crowdsourcing element, I'm like, well, there are enough people that I trust to warrant my adherence to this as a view. And it works within this set of conditions and situations. So I see soft work as a necessary training tool and a very extremely valuable training tool towards a certain goal. But I try not to be fanatical about it. I don't say that that's the only way of training. And I don't believe it is. I think if all that you do is the soft work, then you never find out how you can apply that at speed or how you can apply that with tension as well. So again, I'm applying these criteria. There's a little bit of authority, trust. There's a little bit of crowdsourcing of knowledge, right? And there's a little bit of like, is there a mechanism for this? And yeah, there is. You can look at the neurological literature about how we learn things, and we learn better slow, and we learn better in flow than we do when we're just trying as hard as we can and we're sympathetically activated, right? So there's mechanisms, as you pointed out there, right? Is there extraordinary proof for it working, like in the form of the people that can do it? There is, for me, right? So it's so all of those things I arrive at like are good enough in terms of soft work. But the problem is that you can't transmit that immediately to somebody else. They have to go through their own process of discernment. And I think that's probably necessary, right? Everybody, you shouldn't accept things at complete face value, whether it's a nutritional guideline or somebody telling you how to exercise, how to build strength, or how to, you know, run a marathon, or whether it's somebody telling you how to train martial arts. Like you should, to an extent, kind of weigh things up for yourself, not be the final arbiter yourself. You should rely on other people and judgment and expertise as well. But there should be a little tension there. I think it's healthy to have a little bit of dynamic tension in that.
Yeah. I mean, who wants to be, you know, at the mercy of a guru who might change their mind?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so I follow a meditation teacher, Adyashanti, who says, wouldn't it be terrible if someone could give you the truth? Cause then they could take it away from you.
That's that's very, that's quite brilliant actually. Yeah. Thinking about that. Yeah. And that speaks to that, the problem of our reliance on trust as a means for constituting knowledge. Again, it can be exploited, but that doesn't mean that we can't use trust or shouldn't use trust as a means for building knowledge, right? So, all right, takeaways from all of this, right? How can we protect ourselves from false knowledge? There's some fairly basic things that go on there, right? So unusual claims require unusual evidence. That's good. Okay, you say you can fly, show me. You say you're telekinetic and have crazy powers. I'm going to need to see a little bit of flying stuff before I'm going to believe that. And if not, I'm going to sit with my belief that most people can't fly or have telekinetic powers. Another one is, does it have the hallmarks of fanaticism? Do you know what I mean? Is there a social group that's deeply committed to it in a way that seems like beyond the effectiveness of what it is, right? Does it have kind of, is belief in supernatural forces kind of inherent in it, right? Does it put aside mechanisms and say, trust me, it just flows that way. It's energy or it's whatever it is and that kind of stuff, right? That doesn't necessarily mean, again, that it's not true or it's not useful. It just might be a hallmark of something that has its own self-generating algorithm, right? It's its own little knowledge system that just keeps ballooning out of control as well. Another one is try and see, I think an interesting one is trying to see the whatever small truth is within the other person's viewpoint. To your point about the scientist, if somebody challenges you and says, my research not only didn't duplicate your results, it shows the opposite. Trying to see the truth, what's possible then? How can we both be true, right? So in the case of Kahneman and Tversky, them going sort of saying, well, they must have got the results somehow. So what truth is shared by both of our things? Not it's me versus them, but like, our truth might not be as big as I thought it was. Theirs probably isn't either. Maybe we can find a nested combination that actually includes both of those. And so for me, it's the same with soft work in martial arts versus training like harder and with higher pressures and skills. It's the same with diet, right? I'll accept Ponce's fixed energy budget hypothesis, but I'll also hang on to the idea that psychology, your microbiome and that your metabolism in terms of metabolic health and how you process sugars and how fast are also important. Now, do I know which of those effects is dominant? The effect of like the caloric fixed budget is so big that the others are almost negligible. I don't know. I'm not sure yet. That requires more work in the words of most scientists at the end of every single paper ever, right? Yeah. This remains to be seen. But I'm happy juxtaposing those ideas and holding multiple truths in my head until such a time as I can resolve them. I don't need to know one way or the other immediately. Is there something that's different in the way that you discern things or your kind of third route?
No, I think that's a great summary of, what I want to think about. Like, I'm human and I'm fallible and I get things wrong all the time and I get overexcited by great ideas because they're a good story and yeah. But I think one of the things I do is I run things by you a lot. I can feel myself becoming a cheerleader for something and I'm like, I need a little Glenn here
I need a damper. I need somebody just to just pee on my fire today. Thanks, man. I'm touched that I hold that place, that role in your life.
One of the things I think about, this was from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which I think was written in the early 70s.
I love that book. It's my favorite, one of my faves.
When he talks about, like, at a certain point, we thought science was going to give us all the answers. Like, there were people writing in the 60s and 70s, like, we basically know everything. Mm-hmm. And we're worried, like, what is science going to do once we know everything? Mm-hmm. He's like, no, science is like a circle. And, like, what our knowledge is the interior of that circle, and our ignorance is the perimeter. Mm-hmm. The diameter. Hmm. And the bigger our knowledge gets, the more we don't know.
Sure.
Right. So, yeah. Right. As the area increases, the unknowns increase, and that's never going to end.
Yeah. And, well put.
And so like, how exciting.
Yeah.
How exciting to, like there's a researcher now, Kevin Hall at the National Institutes of Health, who's been doing studies that we thought were impossible, like bringing people into the lab and feeding them and monitoring them for like 3 weeks at a time and testing like, Gary Taub's hypothesis of that carbs make you fat and fat doesn't make you fat and coming up with actual numbers and that, wow, like it's so exciting to be part of science. And I think for me, the wonder and just the privilege of we have this society in which we don't have to spend all our time hunting and gathering. We can go look for this knowledge in this particular way. Yeah. Like when you lose that, then I don't trust you. And when you have that, I trust you.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I'm just reminded of one thing as well in the, that was going to be an interesting point and it fled my mind as soon as it came in there. But just to keep everything in context, right? In Vladimir's words or Michael's words, my Systema instructors, they would just say, don't be a fanatic about anything, including Systema, and what is a fanatic? When you look at the definition of it, it's like, it's somebody that has an unreasonable zeal about something, right? It might be a religion. It might be a political viewpoint, but it doesn't have to be. You can be a CrossFit fanatic. You can be a vegan fanatic. You can be a keto fanatic, right? You can be a science fanatic as well, right? So it's important to keep things in the wider context of just like, what's the relationship between me and this knowledge, between me and the person who's giving me this knowledge, right? And can we relate that all to the place that we're in, like in the words of Tyson? You know, it's like, I think it's really important to keep that, because that stops us going down the rabbit hole of either believing something to be true because one guy who claims to represent science is true, or believing that something is true because one guy who claims to represent, you know, an alternative viewpoint is true, whatever it's going to be. It's trying to keep that big picture and that joy, like you said, of being okay with the fact that you don't know. Like, I honestly think in terms of success in health, right, in fixing your kind of nutritional, your eating plans as opposed to your diet or your lifestyle that you have, as opposed to like short-term ways of losing weight and things, is about your adherence to a set of principles or ideas that you can hold consistently and be like, good enough for me, and it works and I feel healthy on it. And in the wider context of things, this is not damaging the planet or people or whatever it's going to be within my own ethic system, however I construct that. And that works. And there's a solidity to that, even if you don't know that it's 100% the best way of eating ever. It might turn out that the best way of eating ever is that we all eat amino acids that are produced by a machine, you know, in exact quantities to the things. And that might be true. I don't want it to be true. Do you know what I mean? But that might be the ultimate answer. I still might not eat that way in the end. Do you know what I mean? There might be trade-offs and there might be other ways of going. And the same thing with martial arts practice. I think from my point of view and for people who train Sistema, in my experience, the people who do the best are the ones who are okay with not knowing. They're like, oh wow, I got a bit better and I learned a lot more and I can do more things, but it just seems like I've opened up a whole bunch of other ways in which I realize that I fail, or I'm trying too hard, or I'm too tense. And that's okay. If you can't get okay with that, you're not going to progress. You're just going to fall off. If you're looking for the black and white answer, if you're looking for the viewpoint of the fanatic, if you're looking for somebody to tell you exactly how it is and how it always will be, then you've already lost something, I think, in that, regardless of the field that you're working in.
Yeah, it reminds me of a quote in Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, who said the scientific revolution of the 16th century, roughly, was not a revolution of knowledge, it was a revolution of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, we don't know. And that fueled all the discovery.
Beautiful.
On all right. Note, I hope you like that. So let's talk about the stuff we got to talk about. So first of all, 482 is the number. If you want to get the show notes for today's episode, it's plantyourself.com/482. Running, movement news. I've been doing some heavier morning workouts, and so my back tends to be sore all day, but it feels like a different sore. It feels doesn't feel like a, oh gosh, is it about to go out sore, but more of a, oh, you worked it good sore, which I hope will translate into less pain and better range of motion mobility over time. And I did almost a 6 mile run today. I have a long day today. I'm getting this recording in between six different Zoom calls that are all related to a great thing, to the release of my and Peter Bregman's new book, You Can Change Other People, which you can find on Amazon or your local bookstore or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or maybe even airports someday. Who knows? I would love it if you were to get a copy and read it and give us a review and let us know what you think. So garden news, been doing a lot of weeding, sort of indiscriminate weeding with a hoe, like clearing beds entirely. We got a whole bunch of seeds for cover crops and for cool weather greens, a lot of kale. We got 1 pound of kale seeds. Do you know how many seeds are in 1 pound of kale seeds? I don't, but it's a lot. If you wanted to like put it in a glass jar and guess the number, you would probably be checking that for a long time before you you had something definitive. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons. Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Mauro, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filkinowski, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leia Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkis, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franza, Jeanette Benham, Gila Sert, David Donahue, Blair Cyborg, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Bandana Chali, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Lakoski of Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty V. Martino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Paranganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends.